Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
Welcome to today's episode of New Cyber Frontier. On with us today, we have the former Chief Security and Privacy Officer for Intel, and his name is Malcolm Harkins. Malcolm, welcome. Thanks for joining today.
Thank you.
This is definitely going to be an interesting show because Malcolm and I were talking before we signed on here a little bit about what his biggest areas in cybersecurity are and concerns. And they're around the responsibility of society and technology kind of coming together, risk and privacy problems and focuses. But definitely a great show on here today. First of all, though, Malcolm, tell us about yourself, your background, your personal life. How did you get to where you are?
Yeah, I'm a bit of an oddball relative to most of the folks that have run security in corporations. I have only worked for two companies in 28 years. I worked for Intel for 24 years straight out of graduate school, where I got my MBA, and traipsed through a bunch of business jobs, finance, procurement, business operations, some startup activities, until Code Red and NIMDA happened and 9/11 happened in the summer fall of 2001. And then I was asked to run security and business continuity in the IT organization. And over the subsequent 13 plus years, I ended up putting my arms around all aspects of information risk, security controls, compliance activities, corporate emergency operations, product security. And I became Chief Security and Privacy Officer over that time across the entire company. And then 4 years ago, actually next week, I left Intel to go join a startup that nobody had heard of at the time, Silence Corporation, which focused on prevention of malicious code using artificial intelligence and machine learning. And I've been Chief Security and Trust Officer for Silence for the past 4 years, and recently moving on to some other things that we'll figure out what those are here in the coming few weeks to months.
Interesting. You know, I hadn't heard of Silence until you told me about it either, but now I'm definitely going to go look it up. We'll talk about that later. The first thing I wanted to ask and bring up is this Chief Security and Privacy Officer versus CIO, Chief Information Security Officer, CISO. Tell us the difference, because some people might have just breezed through that and thought, oh, it's one and the same. I know when you first said it, I actually thought CISO also. So tell us what your take on the difference in those two roles is.
Yeah, part of it was my evolution at Intel, and even my evolution at Silence, and hence the Chief Security and Trust Officer role at Silence. CISO, the scope, when you think of information risk, every company is becoming a technology company, right? Even think of brick and mortar companies. I know cement companies that are layering in sensors while they're pouring cement in order to sell big data and analytics back to municipalities on when roads are going to deteriorate. Think about connecting that stuff up with autonomous cars and that type of stuff. So even a brick and mortar company is becoming a technology company, right? Mm-hmm. Most CISOs report to the CIO, which means the scope is internal operations by and large, right? The product groups, sometimes the marketing folks, all those other business units are embedding technology into products, services, marketing efforts that is in many cases outside of the scope of the CIO. And so if the CISO or Chief Information Security Officer is underneath the CIO, they're going to be scoped organizationally to what the scope of the CIO is. And in my view, information risk is permeating every aspect of an organization. It's creating social risk, as we were talking about, and ethical and moral dilemmas on how you use the technology and the implications on humanity. And so in my view, that CISO role should be growing in scope to look at privacy, look at business continuity disaster, look at the physical, logical implications of technology, look at the legal and regulatory implications and the other compliance issues around it. And when you start doing that, the CISO role expands broader into a broader set of risks, a broader set of security, a broader set of privacy implications. Hence why my job transformed itself at Intel to Chief Security and Privacy Officer, interlinking these interdependent yet independent risk issues. And just like when I came to Cylance, it's a trust issue at the end of the day. And can you trust the company? Can you trust the technology? Can you trust how they're going to manage your information as a customer, as a partner, as an employee? Hence the evolution of my role to Chief Security and Trust Officer when I was at Cylance.
Awesome. Hold on real quick. We're going to hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
All right, welcome back. Today we're talking to Malcolm Harkins. We were talking about Chief Security and Privacy Officer versus a Chief Information Security Officer. Great explanation you gave right before the break. You mentioned and brought in the concept of trust. So I wanted to, as we continue on from that last conversation, explain to us this whole concept of trust and how it relates. We hear security and privacy all the time. Explain the relation of trust.
Well, trust is a function of two things, competence and character. Competencies are the results you deliver, right? The business outcomes you deliver. And character is all about the integrity, your actions. And what I see by and large is that we have a trust issue when it comes to information and technology. We can't trust today that organizations are going to properly protect consumer data. We can't trust today that the creators of technology are going to put their customers and society first to do the right security development lifecycle and privacy by design to minimize vulnerabilities in technology. And I've been a part of the security industry and the tech industry pretty much all of my life. And I tell people when I get on stage, you can't trust the security industry. And you can't trust it for two reasons, competence and character. Look at the cyber risk issues that have grown unchecked, unmitigated, unmanaged. Look at the growth of the security industry where we've thrown more money at the problem because the security industry profits from the economics of insecurity. So it makes more money the more problems that exist. Mm-hmm. And so you start seeing the interlink then between we haven't demonstrated the competencies as a security industry because we haven't solved the problems. And then when you look at the intent of it, the intent is to make more money off of the problem. So therefore, does the security industry really have the economic incentive to solve it? No. So you as a consumer and as a customer of the security industry, you've got to think about the motivations of who you're dealing with and whether or not they want to keep you on this hamster wheel of risk. Mm-hmm. Or if they're actually fundamentally trying to solve the problem and reduce the risks substantially and over the long haul. And I would venture to say, as I've said for a number of years, that most of the players could care less if you get breached or hacked, which is why they all say, you're going to get hacked. Just give up, give in, right? Which is why most of the industry has focused on detection and response, because that's throwing bodies at the problem. That's throwing more solutions at the problem that don't get to the heart of the real issues.
Okay. I fully agree with you. I guess the next question would be, and this is kind of what we're going to talk about here today, is in order to solve the problem, for one, I think you're right. People don't want to solve the problem because there's money in fighting the problem. It's like, if we solve the problem of making everything fireproof, we don't have the insurance risk. We don't have the firemen. We don't have all the fire equipment. We don't have fire suppression. We don't everything that all the other industries that fight fires go away if you don't have fires anymore. So, yes, I think you're right. It doesn't, economically, the incentive is to not solve and fix the problem. But if we were going to solve and fix the problem, let's identify that problem. What do you say, you know, are the problems that we need to solve? And we had made a list of them before we started here, and that's kind of what we're going to talk about is what are your key problems you see and recommendations to solve in each one of them?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, you know, and again, the reality is, and I've had to explain this to folks, I'm not saying that you can be 100% successful, right? Because you can't eliminate risk physically, logically. There's no way you can eliminate it. But to start from a basis of just accepting it versus striving for, in essence, the zero defect mentality, right? That's the mental shift that we've got to make. So problem number one is we've got to shift our mental model and philosophical model to we can do better than we are today, and we've got to strive for in every aspect understanding the cause and effect of the risk issues. You know, there's as a industry and as a society, we focus on attribution to threat actors and threat agents. Every breach, oh, sophisticated actor, this nation state, this organized crime. Well, okay, that's interesting. But me as a chief security officer, me as a chief information security officer, me as a chief privacy officer, I have no ability to affect the threat actor and threat agents. None. Other than maybe some internal insider risk that I might be able to move the dial on. But I can't affect a nation state actor or organized crime trying to come after me. The only variable I can affect in the risk equation, which is risk as a function of threat times vulnerability times consequence, the only variable that I can play with is how vulnerable I am. Mm-hmm. And so the industry distracts us by talking about sophisticated actors, why to deflect accountability for their solutions that didn't work. Organizations who get breached talk about a sophisticated actor, why to deflect liability because they did a crappy job of managing their vulnerabilities. And if we did attribution to the controls that failed, the processes that failed, the procedures that failed, much like the National Transportation Safety Board does when an airline crashes, they systematically go through and say, what mechanical part failed? What weather pattern caused an extreme event that then brought about metal fatigue? And then how did the pilots and others contribute to that because of the chaos that's going on? That's the type of stuff we need to do. We need to get to the core root causes of these things, and then we can go systemically address them and make real improvements.
You know, I have a thought with that is the information sharing analysis, kind of the information sharing is what I've heard people that have that same thought process are like, well, let's start collecting all the problems, putting them together and sharing that information from one company, from one organization to another, so that we can start to do attribution. But you know what? When I get on to like US CERT and I look at the information coming through an information sharing analysis organization, it's like listening to the police scanner on a million cities around the country at the same time. It's too much information to do anything with. And it seems like as we try to get a grasp on that problem, the big data nature hits us in the face.
Yeah, and I'm a big believer in information sharing, and I've participated in the ISACs, I've participated in a number of collaborative activities and stuff like that. So we need to continue to do that, but all of that information sharing is after the fact vulnerabilities. There's a vulnerability in this operating system, a vulnerability in this application. There's an indicator of compromise because somebody just got owned or somebody was taken out. So it's all reactive, right? And like you said, there's just volume of it. So you get this alert fatigue, right? And the alert fatigue causes what I call the psychological phenomenon of decision maker dementia, right? If I got all this noise coming at me, how am I going to actually, you know, sort out what's relevant, what's not relevant? The only way to reduce the alert fatigue and reduce all of that stuff is to do better prevention up front. If we did a better job of designing, developing, and implementing technology, we'd have less vulnerabilities. If after the implementation of technology, we had better capabilities to dramatically reduce the exploits in technology, we would have less alert volume. And then guess what? You'd have less noise, mm-hmm. in which case you'd actually be able to do a better job of really going after the sophisticated attacks, because you're not dealing with all this volume of just, you know, ambient noise that's causing that alert fatigue.
Yeah. Well, hold on right there. We'll take a break here, hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back in a couple minutes.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
All right, welcome back to New Cyber Frontier. We're on with the former Chief Security and Privacy Officer for Intel Corporation, Malcolm Harkins. Malcolm, before the break, we were talking about the information sharing, and your first major concern is the linking of, you know, attribution of how do we fix problems once they're identified. And I brought up the information sharing. I think, you know, that over the white noise, over inundation, so much information. Is there, you know, how long, just one, like, follow up on that, how long do you think it takes to narrow down where there's not too much information to have decision maker overload?
You know, I think it's doable. I've been able to achieve that in my job as Chief Security and Trust Officer for Cylance. We don't have the alert fatigue. We're not playing whack-a-mole with issues left and right. Mm-hmm. I think if you design and architect your solutions appropriately and get to the core of the problems and stop them before they begin, again, you can't eliminate risk, but you're going to be able to better ascertain and move quickly on things that are relevant, because you're not just drowning mm-hmm. in noise.
Understood. Yep, that one. So your next main area of concern.
My next main area of concern for me, again, and we touched on this a little bit, as I mentioned, every company is becoming a technology company. And even the World Economic Forum in the past couple of years has been talking about cyber risk in the top five risks for the world mm-hmm. across all measures of risk. Up there with climate change, income disparity, aging populations. It, you know, cyber risk is in those categories, right? And I wrote in my second book, Managing Risk and Information Security, that was published 2.5 years ago, an entirely new chapter around thinking about information risk as a social responsibility. Mm-hmm. There's a moral and ethical obligation we have. And as our lives become more and more inextricably linked with technology, real lives are at stake. You know, people will die if an operating room gets ransomed when somebody's, you know, doing open heart surgery. Real people will die if I can muck with the integrity of the prescription that I'm supposed to take to keep me alive. Real people will die when an autonomous car gets taken over or the data gets played with and I go in a different direction and perhaps crash into something. So lives are at stake here, and we need to realize that in terms of what we're doing to frame the problems differently instead of just framing them on risk to my organization and the financial liability of it. Now, that's what Lee Iacocca did when he shipped the Pinto for 7 years. They focused on risk to the company, not the fact that there was a human on the other end of that car whose life might be at stake. And I think if we frame the risk issues differently, we'll make better decisions about how to control for risk.
So we're looking at taking a social, an ethical look at what we do. Now, that's a trade-off to, you're going to spend money for that, right? And I have seen year over year that, you know, in hard times, when budgets gets tight, cybersecurity is one of the first things to get cut inside a company because, you know, for a short period of time, nobody really knows that you cut it. It's only until it catches up with you later after years of, you know, not taking your vitamins and you get really sick. So how do you, I mean, that ethical thing comes with a price tag. How would you recommend relate to people in that dilemma, considering that trade-off?
You know, to be honest, I'll say this, it may come with a price tag. It doesn't have to. Okay. And here's why. I actually gave a talk on this at RSA just a few months ago that I called Expense in Depth. Mm-hmm. Defense in Depth has become expense in depth. And if you take my notion that we've been throwing money at the problem and haven't solved it, mm-hmm. and you start looking at it as an economics issue, you can start looking at the total cost of controls. And you can start seeing that we've actually slowed down our organization's ability to innovate. We've slowed down the business processes because of the ineffective and inefficient security solutions. And we've thrown money at the problem and grown our security budgets without solving it. Now, when you look at it that way, my premise is I can lower the total cost of controls and lower the risks. But you have to look at the total cost, not just the security budget, right? Look at ineffective security solutions that then cause all this reaction after the fact. That mm-hmm. costs more money, right? Rebuilding a building after it's burnt down and sending firemen to go control the fire is way more expensive than building a building with the right sprinkler system, the right fireproofing for things, right? It might cost a little bit more upfront for the construction, but over the long-term total cost, it's more economically efficient. So what I tell my peers is they've got to think about the notion of total cost and then go address that mm-hmm. and then go look systemically across all of the total expenditures that including the inefficiencies that are built in, and then go address those. Because if I was a CEO or, you know, a board, and I go, hey, I can speed up these five business processes by changing these controls and I can reduce the risk at the same time, who's not going to invest in that?
Fair enough. Whenever I look back, though, one question I would ask is, you look at the landscape for cybersecurity controls, cybersecurity products, companies out there. There's thousands. And how do you know who to even listen to would be what I would shoot back. And what's your advice?
Well, at first I go to, let's look at their motivation. How do they make money? Mm-hmm. And if they make money off of your perpetual problems, you might need their solution tactically, but you shouldn't really listen to them strategically.
That's right? An interesting point. I like that.
Right. So that's pretty easy to ascertain. How do they make money? And then what are their messages? Now, then you go into what business outcomes. Hold the security vendor community accountable to a business outcome. If they don't deliver the results that were on the marketing slide, on the sales deck, and in the contrived proof of concept, kick them out, demand your money back, build in clawbacks into your supplier agreement. And guess what? When you get breached because of the solution that you bought from them, go do public attribution to the fact that their solution failed.
Fair enough. I like that kind of thought process. So if we went to your next problem, one that I liked was the integration between security and privacy. Tell us about what that means.
Well, I've long believed, and I've seen and experienced, that the security community, it's gotten better, but by and large, the security community is what I'll call colorblind or tone deaf to privacy. They think if you have security, you therefore have privacy, and that's not true. There's nuances in that. Mm-hmm. And differences of perspective and legal and regulatory items. And in what you've got to think about security and privacy is like two magnets, right? You need good security to have privacy. But if security doesn't understand the nuances of privacy or works council issues or GDPR or other aspects of it, they'll collect and process too much information. They'll architect for security without architecting for privacy. And mm-hmm. privacy sometimes can stay too ethereal, too academic, and not understand the proportionality and needs that you have on the other side of it. And so when either one of those things is in an extreme, it's like taking those two magnets and turning them. And what happens when you turn two magnets? They polarize each other. So for me, it's an architecture and design issue. And what we've got to do is design for both. And instead, what we typically do is say it's a trade-off. I'm going to do security and versus privacy. Well, when you start with trading things off, guess what? You're automatically going to one wins and one loses.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start doing that, you're designing to sub-optimize for both. Just like when we trade off user experience and business productivity for security. That's a design issue. Design for both. And if you design for both, you're going to end up in a better solution set and actually solve for both, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not a balancing equation. It's a calculus equation where you're trying to optimize the coefficients on that multivariate equation.
Mm-hmm. You know, I always like to think, and I look at privacy is the requirements for security. So you're designing the requirements for security around the needs for privacy. But I love your definition there. So, and I think we're down. You had one more major issue you had talked about before you started, and what was that one?
That one was around the structural aspects. Again, when you know, we talked about the CISO reporting to the CIO, or in some cases, people have the CIO also being the CISO, which is an odd thing because there's separation of duty issues there. Because mm-hmm. the head of security's job is to hold the other executives accountable, to dig in, to understand. And that creates a level of discomfort with CIOs or chief technology officers or business unit general managers. The whether it's the CISO or the chief security officer, or the chief privacy officer, chief trust officer, whatever the title is, they need to have a level of independence from these other functions. Now, you can report into them, which is fine, if you still have a level of independence to the board, to the corporate officers, into legal, right? You have to have a separate voice. It's a corporate governance issue because structure drives behavior and you get what you measure. And if you're buried under something else that has a structure that is smaller and has measurements that are different, you're going to suboptimize and bury the risk issues. And so for me, people've got to look at those structures mm-hmm. and create the right level of independence so that you can have the right vision, the right voice, and the right values applied to these risk issues.
Okay, that's definitely interesting. So in kind of wrapping up here today, Malcolm, I wanted to give you the opportunity. Is there anything you need help with from our listeners or you'd like to get out personally about what you do, what your needs are, you know, your organizations you're associated with, whatnot?
Yeah, there's a couple of things, and I know from a lot of my peers, and you can look at ISSA, they do studies every once in a while. And the last one that I read that was like a year and a half ago on the cybersecurity professionals and why they're in this space. You know, a third plus or take a little bit of the people who have taken jobs in security have done it because of the morality of the job. Own that.
Mm-hmm.
Do what you believe, do it where you belong, do it because it matters. You have a voice, use it. There's a time and a place to say, no, this is not happening on my watch, and go walk the chain of command all the way up to the board and force a discussion on acceptable risk. Because people are confusing accepting risk and acceptable risk. And accepting risk is a business process, which doesn't mean it's acceptable risk. And you've got to figure out who you're accountable to and who the risk is going to hurt and make sure that dialogue happens. And then make sure the attribution to the real issue, the controls that failed, occurs.
All right. Well, this has been a great talk and a great show, and I wish you the best of luck. By the time this comes out, I think you said you'll be in a new position, so keep in touch with us and let us know what that is. And
we'd love
to have you back on again to talk about, you know, what the next phase and next thoughts are for your career and everything.
Yeah, that would be great.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining today, Malcolm. You have a great day.
All right. Bye. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.